I've put out a display of material from the White Estate here this morning. Whenever I travel to visit churches and schools and other places, I like to bring with me a sampling of the material that tells a bit of the story of Ellen White and her work and ministry. I have with me several of her handwritten letters. These are originals. These are not copies, but actually handwritten letters that Ellen White wrote to various people. I have a letter she wrote to her sons. I have a letter she wrote when she was just 19 and another one when she was 82. Some of them are easier to read than others. I have one here that she wrote from Dakota, from Swan Lake, Dakota. Now, you folks wouldn't go back that far in terms of when North and South Dakota were not separated, but when Ellen White wrote this letter, it was just Dakota Territory. And this letter is particularly interesting to me because when I was just a boy, about 10, 11, 12, my father pastored the Swan Lake Church in South Dakota, but she wrote from Swan Lake, Dakota. He had Sioux Falls and Swan Lake and, I don't know, five or six others. That was back in the days when you were an old circuit rider here in Dakota country. And I was just a boy, and I remember Swan Lake and Sioux Falls and some of the other places. But we just have a few of the handwritten letters here. I have also copies of Early Present Truth and Youth Instructor and the Health Reformer. I have a facsimile of the First Present Truth with a facsimile of the receipt that was paid, a receipt for what was paid by James White to Charles Pelton. First four issues of the Present Truth that Charles Pelton put together in Middletown, Connecticut, cost $64.50. Meyer Publishing Works come a long ways from there, hasn't it? I have a facsimile of Ellen White and James White's marriage certificate here. We have the original of all of these, but some of them, because there's only one of a kind, I don't take them along with me. But I do have several original handwritten letters and also an envelope from one of the letters that Ellen White wrote, addressed by one of her secretaries when she was in Australia. So perhaps in the break today, you may want to take a look at some of these things and see what they're like. You notice from the schedule that I have listed talking about Ellen White as a person. There's so much to say about Ellen White as an individual. It's very difficult to limit yourself to just a few words in a couple of hours. But I thought perhaps we'd just do a brief sketch of some things that have impressed me about her as a person. I remember a couple weeks ago, I was in northern New England. Had the opportunity of visiting in Portland, Maine, where Ellen White had her first vision. I went out to her birthplace out at Gorham. Went up to Topsom, where she had some of her early visions. Visited her home in Portland, the home she was living in when she and her family went through the disappointment of 1844. And I just had a general opportunity of looking again at places that reminded me of Ellen White's early life. It so happened that a relative of Ellen White through marriage, Gladys Robinson, forgotten what her married name is now, but she's 93. And I interviewed her at the Northern New England Camp Meeting, and I was impressed with something that I've been impressed with several times as I've talked to different members of Ellen White's family who knew her, who talked with her, who lived around her, who observed her. I found that every one of them was so upbeat about Ellen White, very positive about the kind of person she was. But interestingly also, I find that there's a similarity among these various people who were close to her, and that they seemed to have somewhat the same outlook on life that I would think she did. Very optimistic, very positive, and with just a little touch of humor from time to time. I want to talk about her humor in the second part of our time today. But I was thinking about Gladys. She was a Gladys Robinson. She was a sister of Doris Robinson, who was married to Ellen White's granddaughter, Ella Robinson. Some of you have read some of her books. She told me a kind of a cute little story, and we interviewed her in front of the group. She said that when she was just 5 or 6, she was in Australia and near Ellen White. And she went out one day to play with Ellen White's twin grandsons, Herbert and Henry. I've always been interested in grandchildren too, but in twins. By the way, if you want to see a picture of my grandson, I've got one just handy here. But Ellen White had grandsons that were twins, and she was a twin. So there were at least two sets of twins in the immediate family. Well, anyway, she was about 5 or 6 and was heading over to visit and play with the twin grandsons. Let's see, that would probably be cousins, wouldn't it, to her anyway, by marriage. And Ellen White came out of the house, and she saw her, and she came over to her and gave her a big hug. She says, "I never forgot that hug that Ellen White gave me when I was just about 5 or 6. But she also told a kind of an interesting story, how that her father was A.T. Robinson, who began work in Africa. And as I remember, she was born in Africa, the one I was talking to, now 93. But she tells about the fact that her mother was quite an active Bible worker. And one day, as she was going out to give Bible studies, Gladys, who was then just 5 or 6, as this other instance was the same, didn't want her mother to go. And she put her arms around her legs and just hung on to her for dear life and just didn't want her to go. And Ellen White was there, and she told her, she said, "You know, Gladys, your mother's going to go out and give Bible studies, and you should not stop her from going, because she's going to go out and tell people about Jesus." And she talked to her just as a small girl, and she said, "I let go of my mother and ran to the house, and the mother went off and gave Bible studies." Well, several years later, when they were back at Elmshaven, Gladys was now 16, and they were at Elmshaven for a meal, and Ellen White was there at the same table. And as they sat there eating, and near the end of the meal, she said, "I never forget, I was 16, and my grandmother put her head around the corner, and she said, 'Gladys,'" she said she had a very, very deep voice when she was seriously going to say something, "Gladys," and she said, "I remember you from Australia." I wish you could have been there. This dear lady, she just put her hands up like this, and she said, "Oh," she said, "I wondered what I'd done wrong now." And Ellen White said, "Gladys, I remember when you were just 5 or 6 years of age. Your mother was going out to give some Bible study." She said, "When you were told that she was going to do something special and she was going to introduce people to Jesus, she said, you just let go of her legs and you ran up to the house without another complaint and you watched her go and then went on with your play." And she said, "Gladys, someday when there are some stars in your mother's crown because of the fact that she went out to share the message with them," she said, "you're going to share in those stars." And she said, "I never forgot that experience." I was interested as she left the platform. She's 93 and walks with a cane. And as she left the platform, was kind of, limping a little bit, walking with a cane, she turned to the audience and she said, It doesn't hurt. I'm just getting old. And somehow that reminds me of the kind of person that Ellen White was. I have had the opportunity of visiting with several people who knew her quite well and were part of her family. I remember visiting many times with Ella Robinson, who, of course, was Doris Robinson's wife and was a granddaughter of Ellen White. I remember visiting with Mabel Workman, who was another granddaughter. Both of these are gone now. And I suppose I've spent many hours with Evelyn Grace Jacques. She always likes to talk about the fact that she had the same same initials as Ellen White. It was Evelyn Grace White, E.G. White. Only it was Evelyn Grace. And she, for many years, was at Elmshaven and, of course, took visitors through Elmshaven and gave them opportunity to visit that special place where Ellen White lived the last 15 years of her life. And I visited with her many hours. I also had the privilege of visiting with W.C. White's second wife, Ethel May Lacey it was, the one he married in Australia, and I visited with her when she was 95 at the St. Helena Hospital when she was in bed, but certainly hadn't lost her spark and her life at all. And I noticed a common thread as I talked to each of these people. As I talked to them about Ellen White and what she was like, they constantly reminded me that it was not a setting and not a circumstance and not a feeling around her that you were afraid of her or you had to be terribly on guard because she was the prophet. They all talked about the fact that they felt comfortable around her, and she was a very loving and very personable person. There was just nothing of the fear in them normally. Now, of course, as I just told you the story of Gladys, she was for a moment scared of what was going to happen, and then she found out that Ellen White really had something very positive to tell her. And I've commented to these various folks. I said, "Why is it that all of you are so positive in your outlook?" They said, "Well, that's the way Ellen White was, and it was just the way it was around her home. A very pleasant and a happy place, and a place that you did not feel uncomfortable in." And so I have appreciated this, that that was the way it was. You know, her daughter-in-law, Ethel May, or not, isn't Ethel. Anyway, the one, that doesn't sound right, does it? What is her? Is it Ethel May Lacey? I was trying to think. It didn't sound quite right to me. Anyway, the second daughter-in-law, perhaps some of you have heard the story of how when they were coming back from Australia, I think it was in the review. Maybe I mentioned it here already. You know, this is the third workshop that we've had, and I can't remember sometimes which place I've told some things, but they were in Samoa. Did I tell about their experience in Samoa? Perhaps you remember reading it in the review, how that as they were traveling back from Samoa, back from Australia, and they stopped in Samoa, that her daughter-in-law said that they couldn't bring the boat into the shore, but they took smaller boats in a certain ways, and then some of these great big Samoans helped them come into shore. Well, if you've never been to Samoa, you perhaps will not realize that it seems to be almost a virtue to be big. Those Samoan people are great, huge people, both the men and the women. In fact, I was there recently, and they even talked about the fact that in order to be king, you have to be the largest one around. And the king of Samoa, or the leader of Samoa today, is a great, huge man. He must be 300-plus pounds, great, huge man. And most of them, or many of them, seem to be quite large. Well, she tells about the fact that these men, as they, some of them waded out in the surf, and they made a kind of a chair and carried Ellen White into the shore. And she sat down on a rock near the shoreline, and then some of them went back out to get some of the others. And her daughter-in-law was on the boat, and of course she was considerably younger than Ellen White, and as one of these big fellows came up to her, he just turned his back to her and he said, motioned her to climb on. So she tells about this experience, how this she grabbed this big fellow around the neck and wrapped her legs around his big tummy, and as he waded through the surf to the shore. And she talks about him being greasy. Well, of course, in the water, you know, it's wet and so forth, but it was hot. And so she wades through the surf into shore with her arms wrapped around his neck and her legs wrapped around that big tummy. And Ellen White was watching this and got to laughing. And she said she laughed so hard she fell off the rock. That somehow reminds me a little bit of the kind of person that she was, a very, very special person who enjoyed the funny side of things many times. I, of course, have studied about Ellen White for many years, and particularly as I've looked at the records of her early life, and I discovered not too long ago, as I was reading a book by James White called Life Incidents, he was talking about Ellen White as a girl. We know she was a twin, of course. By the way, her twin sister never became a Seventh-day Adventist, her twin sister Elizabeth. We recently discovered her grave near Portland, and we've been looking for several other things that we can add to our tours. But when Ellen White was younger and in school, James White tells about it in his book, and he tells about the fact that when she was a younger student, before she had her accident at the age of 9 or thereabouts, that particularly near the end of her formal schooling, when she was in the upper grades, she was a very bright student. She was a very active student, and in fact, when she was in those grades, probably in the later grades, the teachers often would call upon her to help the younger students read and do their lessons. She was very outgoing, a very positive person, and with this in mind, it reminded me of how the accident certainly changed her whole outlook on life. She became a very shy, very bashful, a very introverted person, at least in those early years, because of this accident. You know, as you read, for instance, about her experience as a girl, how that she noted that her friends were sometimes quite cruel because they, ones that had been friends before the accident when she was disfigured and because of this broken nose and so forth, she noticed that they gradually left interest in her. And she talks about the fickleness of all of us sometimes, that looks mean so much. And she had to live a fairly lonely life in those earliest years after her accident where her nose was broken and she didn't go back to school. This is the picture we have of her then as a very young girl. We know, for example, that in 1840, 41, and on up to 44, Ellen, of course, with her family, accepted the preaching of William Miller, joined the Millerite movement, and looked for Christ's coming. She, with her family, had to go through the experience of being disfellowshipped from the Methodist Church, of which they were members. I have seen the actual records that show her disfellowship. I've seen them, I've held them in my hands. The church no longer stands in Portland, but the church that's taken its place, we visited with the clerk of that church some years ago, and held in our hands the book in which it shows that that she and her family were disfellowshipped from that church. That was a tough experience for an early teenager. She was, well, let's see, she was disfellowshipped probably 14 or 15. I've forgotten the exact age because of the time of year. But just a girl, the age here of my young friend in front. They continued to witness for their belief in the second coming of Christ, and as a result of this experience, of course, they were put out of the church, but Ellen White also had the very satisfying experience of bringing almost all of her friends into the belief of, of the second coming of Christ. She talks about it. I think she says all but one accepted my urging to prepare for Christ's coming. So before she ever was given the gift of prophecy, Ellen White was an active soul winner. She didn't hesitate to share her faith, no matter what age. And particularly, it must have been difficult for her at that age in her early teens to share her belief with others, particularly as some of them from her former friends in the church rejected her. And, of course, she and her entire family put out of the church because of their belief in the second coming of Christ. Now, when I say her entire family, I suppose we ought to qualify that because Ellen White was one of eight children. There were some of her older brothers and sisters who already were married and were gone from home. I'm talking particularly the ones who were still at home, not the entire family of father, mother, and eight, but several of them. In fact, two of her older sisters were married to ministers of other churches and never joined the Advent movement at all. I have enjoyed visiting in those early places where she lived and worked and had her early experiences. She met James White at about the age of 16. This, of course, was just before the disappointment. And after the disappointment, they continued to see each other. Of course, as she began having visions and began traveling, sharing her visions, James White was attracted to her. And in the process of time, they became very interested in each other. And he sometimes even traveled with the group when Ellen White shared her visions when she was still quite young. James White talks about this and the experience of getting acquainted with her. And like many couples, they have different ideas as to when they first met. Maybe one made an impression more quickly than the other. Have you had that experience? I could tell you about when I met my wife the first time. She didn't give me even the time of day, and it was very frustrating. But I keep reminding her of that. She says, "I don't remember." Well, I said, "I sure do." Anyway, when they first met, they had no idea of marrying, as Ellen White talks about it, and James. In fact, James had been involved with the Advent movement, of course, prior to meeting Ellen. And that's a whole story in itself. As just a young fellow of in his 20, 21, he began going out and preaching about the second coming of Christ. And we know that in one particular campaign, one particular swing of visiting several different towns in Maine, that there were more than 1,000 who accepted the preaching of James White and joined the Millerite movement. So he was a very active part of the movement. His story is all interesting in itself. You know, he didn't go to school till he was 19. He had a serious illness when he was quite young, and it left him cross-eyed. And for several years, he didn't attend school. I mean, he didn't even start school. And then suddenly, in his late teens, 18, 19, the physical condition cleared up, and he went to school for the first time at the age of 19. Went to school for a few weeks, and then went out to teach, believe it or not. And he taught a year, and then went back to school for postgraduate work, and taught again. And it was in this setting that he was introduced to the second coming of Christ, and of course accepted this belief from his mother and went out to preach. I don't mean to get sidetracked on James, but just to move him into the picture a little bit more. When he first went out to preach in Maine, he said, "I went out with three sermons. One to talk about Daniel 8:14 and how it should be presented. Another to answer arguments that we don't know the time or the hour of Christ's coming." You know, that was the question a lot of people raised. Well, the Bible says you're not supposed to know the day or the hour. And he had several arguments on this. And I forget the third area. Anyway, there were three different areas. I guess another exposition of the whole thing. And he talks about the fact that eventually he kept dividing these sermons, and pretty soon he had a whole series that he could preach. He talks about going out in the fall of that first year, snugly buttoned up in his overcoat in Maine. Well, if you've ever been up there in October and November, you know exactly what it's talking about. When he headed out for his preaching circuit, why, it probably was getting pretty brisk, and he went out. But what I was going to start to say was that when they first met, just before the disappointment, just after, had more opportunity to be together, they really didn't think of marriage, although they were attracted to each other. And James White, actually in the Millerite movement, had written an article in one of the Millerite papers suggesting that it was so late in the Earth's history that you shouldn't marry. Well, of course, after he met Ellen White, or Ellen Harmon, he had to revise that a bit, and eventually, after praying much about it, they decided that the Lord was leading and they were married. And James was 25, Ellen White was 18 when they were married. She had been having visions for about a little more than a year, and they began their work together at that very young age. Later on, when James White wrote about Ellen White, he wrote many things about her, but one statement I like especially, and he was asked about Ellen White and how his feelings were about her. He called her, he said it this way, he said, "She is my crown of rejoicing. She is my crown of rejoicing." He was very positive about Ellen White. Well, we also have an interview in which Ellen White was asked what she thought about James White, her husband. And this was years after he had died, as I recall. I can't remember the exact date, but when she was asked about her husband, she used a very quaint expression. She said, "No better man ever trod shoe leather." That was her feeling about James, a very special person. No better man ever trod shoe leather. After James and Ellen White were married, they lived for 6 years with other people. They never had a home of their own. She lived with her parents and with her sister and her husband and with friends at various places. They didn't have a house of their own. And it's interesting that in those early years when she didn't have a house of her own and didn't have a family privacy, I suppose they must have gotten used to having other people around, because finally when they went to Rochester and established our first printing press there in Rochester, New York, we bought a little hand press. When I say printing press, you know, we must be reminded that this hand press that they used to print the Review and these other papers was just a little thing that you just cranked by hand. There was no electricity, no steam, no anything. I mean, it was all handwork, and they folded by hand and so forth. Whenever I look at some of those early reviews, I have to remember on what kind of a press they were printed. It was a very simple and very primitive type of thing. But anyway, when they went to Rochester and settled there, Ellen White was, they wanted to have a home of their own, and so Ellen White and James White began looking. They found a home on Mount Hope Avenue, not too far from the present cemetery down toward town. And this house was quite nice. They felt it was adequate for what they needed, but they didn't have much money. And so what they did, this was not only their house, but they set up the printing press in the house. And then, because it was large enough, why, several of the others who were involved with the printing lived in the house with them. It was kind of like a boarding house. So even their first house was not private. But it was the first one. By the way, as you, I'm sure, have read, I think it's Life Sketches, but as you probably have read, they paid $175 a year rent for that first house. And several of the folks that were involved with the press lived in it. I don't know whether you've ever sat down and analyzed what they did, but do you remember James White went out to buy furniture? He bought some old broken-down beds and some chairs and some other odds and ends of things. She talks about them eating their meals on a fireboard. I don't know even what that is. I guess just I don't know, what's a fire board? I've often thought about that. Bob, you're older than I am. You know what a fire board is? I don't know. Maybe, here, you have... That's possible.
Yeah.
Yeah, that could be.
I think that is it, because all right, when they were at Saratoga Springs in 1851, just before they went to Rochester, they used this fireboard on the top of a couple of barrels or so to fold the papers.
Yes.
They used a fireboard, I think, for that term was used there.
Well, it was a very primitive situation, to say the least, but one of the things that's interesting to me is I looked through the shopping list that James White followed when he bought furniture. Do you know what he paid for his furniture there? $2.12. You go down through the list, and he paid $2.12 for the whole house full of furniture that he provided for his wife. The way she puts it is, I think, I'm sure there was a smile on her face when she said it, but she talks about him, that he presented me with this. And I've thought, I could just see her smiling about this broken down furniture. They repaired it and fixed it up, and that's the way they set up. But then, of course, they had the others working in the home with them, and many of them staying there. As you've looked at this story, you perhaps have not realized what these people were, who they were, but James White was the oldest of the group. He was 31. He was the oldest. Ellen White was the next oldest. She was 25. Uriah Smith joined them at the age of 21 there at Rochester. His sister, Annie Smith, was 24. And then they had George Amidon. I believe he was 23. I don't have the list in front of me, but I've often talked about it and thought about it. There was also a 17-year-old and a 13-year-old who swept up the place after the day's work. So the group that published our first at our first publishing house ranged in age from 31 to 13. That was the group that published at Rochester. James White, the patriarch of the group at age 31. This challenges me today to be reminded that really the Adventist Church was begun by young people. And I'm not so sure but what the work is not going to be finished by the younger generation. At least they're going to have, I think, a more active part, and I just am challenged as I think about this. I often visit schools, and I try to challenge young people to be reminded that this work was begun by young people. And I think in the end, God is going to expect young people to be very active participants in it. What do you think? Well, it was an interesting experience to set up there. And, of course, the work formally began with that printing press and went on from there. That was, of course, in the very earliest time of publishing. Wherever the press went, James and Ellen White went. If you have ever read Spalding's book, he refers to it as the peripatetic press. That is, it peripatetic meaning traveling from place to place. And in actual fact, the press, as it went from place to place, went where James and Ellen White went. That was the press. It wasn't until, of course, in Battle Creek that James White turned over the press to the church and every way that didn't just follow James and Ellen White wherever they went. We have so many stories about Ellen White as a young mother. She had four sons, no daughters. I'm reminded that when in 1860 her youngest son was born, that she already had three sons. And when this fourth son came, and this is again just conjecture on my part, but when the fourth son was born, Ellen White didn't have a name for him. I think she was hoping for a girl, frankly. And so when this fourth son was born, they had no name. And if you read the letters of that particular time, and she writes to James as he travels away from home, and when she talks about him in her letters to others, she refers to him as the nameless one. She says, the nameless one. Help me find a name for him. I imagine she had several girls' names picked out, and when this fourth son came, she just didn't have a name for him. He finally named him John Herbert. Shortly after he was born, just very young, James White had a trip away from home. And as he left, planning to be away for some time, he put money in the hands of some local brokers. I don't know what you would call them at that time, but men who were to keep money, like a bank, I suppose, and offer interest on it. They were planning to do some building in Battle Creek, and so James White had left some money with these men. And then he went off on this itinerary alone, as his wife, Ellen, of course, with this small baby was in hand, stayed home. This is one of those interesting incidents of the early experience of James and Ellen White, because as he left home and went on this journey, he had a dream. And in this dream, he saw that this youngest son was very ill. And he also saw these men in which he had, the men that he'd left money with, he saw them poor and in rags, as if they were broke. Very vivid dream. But particularly, he was concerned about the fact that the dream indicated his infant son was very ill. Well, with this dream in mind, James White cut his trip short and came home. And when he came home, his youngest son was healthy and seemed to be growing and well. But within a very short time, he became very ill and died. Brain infection, just 3 months of age. This experience reminded him that no doubt the Lord had given him a message that he should get home so he could be there when his youngest son died, so he could be some comfort to his wife. But he got to thinking about the other part of this dream, these men in whose hands he had placed money, and he felt that perhaps there was something to that, and so he contacted these men and got his money back from them. This money was used to build. I've forgotten what it was at that time. Maybe participate in the college. Bob, you might remember this. I'm not sure what it was. But the point of the story is that he did get the money away from these men and was able to get it back safely, and within just a short time they went bankrupt. And everyone else who had placed money with them lost their money. And James White had saved it. And he felt that the Lord had sent this dream to him, which, of course, we would believe too. And he was able to save the money and, of course, also able to be home to give comfort to his wife at the death of the infant. Of course, you know, James and Ellen White's oldest son, Henry, died at the age of 16 of pneumonia. He was up at Topsom, Maine. The Howland home was a favorite place. In fact, the first 5 years of his life, he lived with the Howlands. James and Ellen White had to do a great deal of traveling, and so they left Henry with them, and he spent about 5 years with them. And they were back there later at the age of 16. He got pneumonia, took pneumonia and died, and up in Topsom. So Ellen White lost two of her sons at very early ages. She often referred to Henry as her sweet singer, very musical. In fact, he and the other boys often sang together and played musical instruments and so forth. But he died at the age of 16 of pneumonia. And a special book was published. That was not an uncommon thing, by the way, in those days. Death often came so young to people that they often made quite a production of the death. sometimes even a book. And this was what was done when Henry died. Ellen White put together, or at least James White or Ellen White, I don't know, probably James, put together a book, Appeal to Youth. And this book included the story of Henry and also included a large collection of Ellen White's letters to her sons down through the years. And this little book was published, An Appeal to Youth, with Henry's last words of encouragement to other young people to be faithful till Jesus comes. It's a very interesting little book. If you ever have a chance to see it or read it, the copies, of original copies, are extremely rare. We have several in our office. But I've often thought it might be interesting sometime to republish that little book, because I think it gives an insight into Ellen White and her sons that would be special. But anyway, he died at 16. Ellen White's other two sons both grew to adult life, and of course both had a very active part in the church. In fact, they both, I think, made a very, very strong mark in the church. Edson, the older of the two, of course, pioneered the work among the black population in the South with the building of the boat, the Morning Star. Took it down the Mississippi and down into the South, and really was a major pioneer among the black population in the South, when it really was not easy to work in that particular role because of the terrible prejudice that existed at that time and the difficulty of it. But he had read some counsel that his mother had written, and it impressed him to do the work. And so he had headed down to the South to begin this work among the population in the South, and spent some time with that. We think of this as a major contribution of Edson's. He also, of course, began a press on the boat. In fact, the boat had several things. It had a chapel, it had a press, they had school, did some school work on it. It was just kind of an all-purpose vehicle, or means of transportation at least. And he made a very positive contribution in this way. Willie, the other son, the youngest of the surviving sons, after James White died, accompanied Ellen White pretty well everywhere she went. In fact, in vision, she was shown that the Lord had a special work for her other son, Willie, to be with her and to work with her. And she says, I was shown in vision that your special responsibility is to work with me and help. And he did the rest of Ellen White's life. You see, James White died about halfway through Ellen White's ministry. She lived another 34 years afterwards and continued to be very active in her work. Going back a bit earlier again, we of course have many, many different instances. I think of thinking also of Ellen White's home. I'm reminded that it was a home that was often occupied by others. Visitors were there even all through her life. I can think of one time, for example, when they had a general conference session in Battle Creek. And if you can imagine this, the editor of the review, Uriah Smith, put a little notice in the review that the general conference session was to be held in Battle Creek. But he said, I just want you to know, and I'm paraphrasing it, I don't have it in front of me exactly, but he said, I want you to know that not everyone who comes can plan to stay with James and Ellen White. Imagine the president of the, or the editor of review saying this, if somebody comes to Washington for a general conference or wherever and say, not everyone can stay with Neil Wilson. That's in effect what he was saying. And he went on to say, you know, when they travel, they visit with others and they stay with others, but he said, that's quite different from one couple staying and then everyone coming in on that James and Ellen White. It's obvious that some people felt that they could stay at her place and whenever they came, and in fact, many times they did. We have diary entries that talk about this. I can think of, for instance, in 1859, and you'll find this in the little book, Messenger of the Remnant. She talks about one time when there were 35 at her table for a meal. 35 at her house for a meal. And the diary entry for the next day, it says, we were much worn out. The April 19 diary for that year, 1859, she has this interesting entry. In the evening, Brother Hilliard comes with his wife and 7 children. We are glad to see them and keep them overnight, and she never finished the sentence. I've often wondered what interrupted her. I think I told you the other day, and again, I can't always remember, I sometimes put things incidentally in, and then I don't remember whether I've said it, but in Australia, she wrote to Lucinda, and in this letter, she indicated that she was having the same situation, many people visiting, and she said, it's almost like there's a sign out in my front lawn, free room and board, everybody welcome. This is the kind of home that she had, a very busy and a very active place, and of course, always something going on. Ellen was a very practical person. She was a very careful person in saving. We could tell many stories of this particular aspect of her life. One time in Rochester, she felt that with money scarce, she ought to save money for an emergency. And she knew that her husband perhaps would also find an emergency for it that maybe she didn't agree with, and so she didn't tell him about it. Hung a stocking behind the door in the kitchen. I don't know whether that's a testimony as to how little time he spent in the kitchen, but anyway, she hung this stocking behind the door in the kitchen and began to put little bits of money in it week after week as her husband laid money aside for her to care for food and the household needs. She was saving it for an emergency. Well, weeks and weeks went by, and every week she was putting money into this stocking. One day, James White came in very discouraged. He said, you know, we don't even have money enough to pick up the paper to print our next issue of the review. What are we going to do? Well, she thought a moment, and she said, we've got to continue the paper. So she went out to the kitchen and took them down this stocking with the money in it, and I can just picture her taking it into the front room, perhaps, and turning it upside down, and out rolls the money, bits and pieces, sometimes small coins. Counted out the money, and it was just enough, $64, to pay the paper bill. And I've often thought about James White going down to the rail station with a bag of money or his hands full of this money in bits and pieces and paying for the paper. Very, very conservative, very saving person. And this was the way she was. She grew up this way. And yet, very generous with her money that she had. She talks about the fact, and I don't know where it all came from. I suppose some people entrusted money to her from time to time. We know they did. But she talks about the fact at one time that her husband and she together had given more than $30,000 to various projects. Now, I can't imagine that was all personal income. Perhaps it's money that had been entrusted to her by friends or whatever, some of it at least. But she comments on this. She says, the Lord saw he could trust us with it, and so he kept pouring it in, and we kept pouring it out. I've often thought about that, and perhaps that's one reason why some of us aren't richer. The Lord maybe wonders if he can trust us with that much. I don't know. I've often thought about Ellen White's role in so many ways. You know, the church, the Adventist church, is really not buildings or institutions, it's people. And as I think about the various people that were drawn together to begin this church and this movement, I can't help but be reminded once again that these people were committed, dedicated, not a lot of money, but the Lord used these people in a marvelous way. They had to go through some very difficult times. They didn't have much money in early years. But they went out and did what needed to be done, and of course, the Lord blessed. I think of another story about Ellen White, and I'm sure some of you may have heard the story about rag carpets. But Ellen White was one who wanted to save, and of course, she was very careful in terms of her saving. One of the things that she did at one time when they were in Battle Creek, she decided that she would, instead of buying carpets for the floors, she would make them out of rags. Now, I have never been involved with that. I suppose maybe some of you ladies here would know what a rag carpet is. I know what it is, but I've never seen it made. But anyway, she was gathering rags from her neighbors to make carpets. And she would get these rags, wash them, and carefully pile them in the living room, and she'd sit there and tear them up and then make rag carpets out of these rags that she was getting. Well, James White was embarrassed about this. He didn't think she ought to be making rag carpets. In fact, often when he'd bring someone important in from somewhere, he'd find his wife sitting there with a great pile of rags making carpets, and he was embarrassed. He says, you know, you ought not to do that. You got more important things to do. But she said, you know, I'm saving money. Well, he just couldn't talk her out of it. Well, James White was quite musical, and he decided one day he would try a different tack. So when he came in from the office, he came down the front walk and into the house, and he was singing. And he was singing one of the common tunes of the day, but with some very interesting words. Not the words that were originally intended, I'm sure, in that hymn. And he was singing like this, "In expectation sweet, we will watch and wait and pray until Christ's triumphant car we meet." That would be a train. "And see an endless day. There'll be no rag carpets there. There'll be no rag carpets there. In heaven above where all is love, there'll be no rag carpets there." Well, he walked into the house singing at the top of his lungs, and Ellen White decided that maybe she ought to put aside the rag carpets. Rather interesting sequel to this story. And that is when James White was very ill, and they had to go up to northern Michigan, and they settled up there for a time to get her well. She really had the last word, because what happened, she took up these rag carpets and sold them, and it helped to pay their way to go up there. And she reminded her husband that the rag carpets, after all, weren't too bad. An interesting home, certainly. By the way, thinking about that trip to Michigan, this, of course, takes us to the time when James was very ill. He'd had a physical breakdown. They went to Dansville, New York, to get special help for him. And at that particular place, James had implanted in his mind some very negative things. I think, as I mentioned, perhaps another day, one of the things they were teaching at Dansville, at this special place where they were trying to get James well, was that if you were sick, you should do no physical work. You should just sit around, do nothing. Not work, not be physical in any way. Well, Ellen White had received visions in this regard early on. In fact, just a short time before this, indicating, among other things, that the sick should exercise, certainly in a limited way, depending on what the needs were. But this was one of several things that were happening at that particular institution. They were practicing certain things that she knew were not in harmony with what God had shown her, and so she finally took her husband away from there. And they went to Rochester. This was in the winter of 65, and then decided to go up into northern Michigan. And there they settled for a time. with the particular purpose to get her husband well. Well, they went up there and, of course, stayed through a cycle of seasons. We know, for example, while they were there that she planted a garden. She told her youngest son, Willie, to go down to get three hoes, one for herself and one for James and one for Willie. He was just, I think, 11 or 12. And so he did. When they came back with the hoes, she told her husband, "Now, James, I have one for you and one for me and one for Willie." Well, James resisted. He said, "I can't do any physical work. I'm sick." Well, she didn't argue with him too much. She just got out with a hoe and got Willie out with a hoe. James was a very proud man, and he wasn't going to let her do it without him. And so that way she got him out hoeing. In the wintertime, they had the same problem. He didn't want to get out and exercise. And Ellen White said, "Well, I'm going to go out, and I'll make the footprints in the snow, and if I can go out there, you can." Well, what do you do? James White followed her lead and went out and did his exercise, even in the snow. He also wanted to avoid visitors. Whenever anyone came to the house, he'd slip off to the back side of the house. He was just not wanting to have visitors. Didn't want to talk to anybody. He just was not well. And Ellen White began to notice this, and she said to herself, "Well, if I'm going to get him well, he really needs to associate with people. He really needs to get an opportunity to talk with them and the visitors." And so often would, if she'd see someone coming, she'd try to make it sure that before he could get away, why they'd be in the house, and then he couldn't get away. And he'd have to visit. And it helped him to get his positive attitudes back in cycle. We also have a kind of an interesting story of that same time where they had hay. And they'd grown a crop, and when it came time for hay, she knew that James would not want to go out and do it. They'd gotten acquainted with some of the neighbors up to this time, and she just felt sure that James was going to go out and get the neighbors to bring in his hay. So Ellen White went around to the neighbors ahead of him, and she said to them something like this. She said, "Well, now we're going to, the haying time's come, you're very busy with your work." And they'd say, "Yes." And she'd say, "Well, my husband's going to come around and ask you to help him. You tell him you're too busy." A little bit of a plot. And so she went around to the neighborhood and told them that she wanted her husband to do the haying and tell him that they couldn't do it. Well, they didn't want to do this because they wanted to be helpful, but Ellen White said, you just don't come and do our hay." So James, a little bit later, went around to the neighbors asking for help, and sure enough, all of them said they couldn't come. And he came home very discouraged. He said, "I just don't understand these neighbors. They don't want to help me with my hay." And so Ellen White said, "Well, that's all right. We can do it." And so they did. They got out and put the hay up in the wagon and loaded it, and James and Ellen White and their son Willie put in the hay that fall. And this was the way she helped him to get well. He needed to get back to physical labor. I think also the fact that when she was there, why she had some opportunities to go out and preach, and as she was asked to go out and preach, why James just didn't want to go. He wasn't well, he just didn't participate. But finally, she persuaded him to come, and one time she even persuaded him to come up on the platform behind her. And when she got up that particular day, he hadn't preached for a long time, she said, "We're glad to be here," something like this, and then she turned to her husband and she says, "My husband has something he wants to say." Well, he couldn't get away. And so he got up and spoke. Just a little tricky, maybe. But this was the way she really got him back to activity again, and he got up and spoke. And she talks about the fact that as she was sitting on the platform there, she just wept because she knew he was on his way to health and strength once again. I'm just so pleased that the Lord chose someone such as Ellen White. I think she was a very special person, and she certainly was used in a way that is just remarkable. This is just a quick look at so many things about her, and there's so many more we could say. But the last half of our time, after we take a little break and have a chance to look at these things, I want to talk a little bit further about the humor of Ellen White and perhaps the two sides, not only the humor, but the emotion that she projected in both sides as she was God's messenger.
This concludes another lecture from the 1986 E.G. White Estate Prophetic Guidance Seminar held at Andrews University. As a service to the church and in cooperation with the E.G. White Estate, this has been a Special American Cassette Ministries production. International copyright, 1986, all rights reserved. For additional copies of this message or for other outstanding educational and inspirational cassettes, please write to American Cassette Ministries. Post Office Box 922, Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, ZIP 17108. Waiting to serve you. This is American Cassette Ministries. We're a nonprofit corporation helping prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ.